From Springfield, this is State Week, a program of analysis and commentary on the events that made news this past week in Illinois state government and politics.
It's not just grief. I also share your rage at the loss of life that occurred at LaSalle. What I was told was happening there is a far cry from the circumstances set forth in the IG's report. I was not aware that the policies and protocols were not being followed. We were told that they were being followed.
To me, a good leader doesn't just assume that things are happening. A good leader actually checks to make sure that things are happening.
That state representative, Republican Deanne Mazzocchi, in an exchange with the deputy governor, Saul Flores, during a hearing this week. It was focused on the COVID outbreak that occurred in the fall at the LaSalle Veterans Home. 36 residents died, and we found out more about how officials at the home and the Department of Veterans Affairs handled it all. Also, Illinois takes another step toward getting back to normal, the bridge phase now kicking in. We'll discuss that and more coming up on State Week. In Springfield, I'm Sean Crawford. Our panel includes Charlie Wheeler, emeritus professor and former director of the Public Affairs Reporting Program at the University of Illinois Springfield. He's also been a longtime State House reporter and observer. And with us, we have Hannah Meisel, NPR Illinois State House editor. And joining us today, Tony Arnold, who covers state government and politics for WBEZ. Tony, it's always good to have you with us.
Oh, thanks for having me. Good to be here.
Hannah, lawmakers at the Capitol wanting to know more details about what happened at the LaSalle Veterans Home last fall. There have been some hearings going on. What have we learned so far this week?
That's right. It was 2 weeks ago that the governor's office published this damning report on what went on with this massive COVID outbreak at the LaSalle Veterans Home that eventually killed 36 residents, which is more than a quarter of the home's population. And so since then, there have been a lot of calls for, you know, more investigation, more oversight, more sunlight, for lack of a better word. And so this week, the House Veterans Affairs Committee held two separate hearings on the report. And the more revealing one was Thursday when Deputy Governor, as you said, Saul Flores, who her portfolio includes things like human services and congregate care, she basically told lawmakers that she was misled by former state VA director Linda Chapalivia, who, as we've discussed before, was, before she was appointed, a 16-year state representative, a Democrat from up in Aurora. And so, yeah, she, Saul Flores said, basically, yeah, I was misled. I was, especially during the pandemic when we were limited to video calls and emails, I was led to believe that everything on the ground was fine. When I took a look at data I had compiled in the fall, and it's crazy how quickly the virus spread within the first week there at the home. More than 80 residents, more than 80 staffers had already been infected. Saul Flores's comments seemed targeted toward, again, pointing the blame on these folks who are now gone from the Department of Veterans Affairs, but also shielding the governor's office from culpability by saying, you know, we didn't know, we were misled. So very, very interesting stuff there.
Yeah, Tony, is that good enough? I mean, like Hannah was saying, it's and it may be the truth what they're saying, but it is sort of coming across as, you know, we just didn't know. We were duped, possibly, you know, as to what was actually taking place there. Any thoughts on that?
Pretty stunning to me how the governor's office at this hearing threw Chapalivia under the bus. And in her team that she had put in place at IDVA. And the reason that's stunning to me is because of how, I mean, this is a governor, the governor's administration, making these accusations against his own appointment. Now, the governor Pritzker's publicly said that he regretted putting Chapalivia in this role. That's on the governor. I'm having a hard time remembering here the last time that this something so governor's administration has so publicly attacked one, you know, a member of his own administration like they're doing here with Chapalivia. I say all this with the caveat that we don't have the full picture, because where is Chapalavia, the former Veterans Affairs director? She did not cooperate with the inspector general in his investigation of how this outbreak got so bad and so quickly and where everyone was. She wanted the questions in writing, and the inspector general said, no, you're going to talk to us like we talk to anyone else. And so she refused to cooperate with that. And we still haven't heard from her in these legislative hearings. My understanding is that she has an attorney. Maybe she's not coming public because she has some sort of liability here that she's concerned about, whether it be civil or otherwise. Certainly there have been calls, partisan calls, I should say, for a criminal investigation, which the Attorney General's office has said that they are not undergoing at this time. But, I think that there's, I want to hear from Chapalavia about what she thinks of this report, how it's been characterized, and how the governor's office is claiming that she misled them.
Yeah, Charlie, your thoughts on that? You've watched government a long time, and you watch scandals come and go, and things go wrong in state government, and the follow-up that takes place. Your thoughts on how this is playing out?
Well, I think the bottom line in all of this is, and this has been true historically, the governor is the chief executive officer of the state. And the bottom line is he's the one who's responsible. He's the one who's going to have to wear the jacket for this. Now, I think, as I said the other week, I would have been more concerned when I saw what was happening around the nation and in other venues in terms of how this stuff was spreading. And I might have told my public health people, yeah, the director says not to worry, but I want you to send a team out there just to see what the heck's going on, which did not happen. There was a delay of several days. And Tony, you can correct me if I'm wrong, this is kind of reminiscent of what happened at the Quincy Veterans Home with the Legionnaire's disease. One difference I get is that the Rauner administration actively tried to cover up some of that stuff. And I don't get the impression that Pritzker's administration is trying to cover up, at least from what we know now. It's more Pritzker's administration saying, well, we didn't know. And I would argue, well, then you guys weren't doing due diligence. You should have just checked up, particularly at an issue like this. If there's some problem in some other agency that doesn't affect people's lives, and you figure, okay, we'll rely on the people at the agency level to take care of it, that's fine. But on a deal like this, and on an issue, particularly with the history of the veterans' homes, with the danger of this disease to people in congregate settings, particularly senior citizens, I mean, I think they should have been more on top of it.
Yeah, Tony, your thoughts on parallels between this and Quincy? You covered Quincy quite a bit.
There are plenty of parallels and plenty of differences, I would say that. For one thing, Legionnaires' disease is not COVID-19. Legionnaires is a preventable bacteria that lives in water pipes and is breathed in. And in that instance in Quincy, it was a recurring case, outbreaks over multiple years. And in many of those cases, we documented the ways that the administration at the time was not notifying the public in a timely manner. Here you're dealing with a global pandemic at LaSalle, where LaSalle, the what happened at LaSalle is among the deadliest outbreaks of long-term care facilities of in regard to COVID-19 in the state. It's not the deadliest, but it's among them. And you know, the situation here, while we could talk about it was how it was mismanaged, the fact is that it's not unique to LaSalle. That plenty of other long-term care facilities in Illinois and outside of Illinois struggled in one way or another. This is not to say to give the governor's administration any kind of pass. It's just to say that I think that there are some differences here. And another key difference is to go back a little bit and what kind of accountability Governor Pritzker is calling for from his administration versus what Governor Rauner did. Rauner in Quincy, to the end, defended his administration and his response to it, the Legionnaires' disease outbreaks, even though it kept coming back. And even though his administration did not tell people that there was an outbreak there in a timely way. Here, in this case, Pritzker fired Chapalavia, or at least asked for her resignation, whatever you want to call it, semantics, and has a new IDVA director who seems to be very, and Terry Prince, who seems to be very forthcoming with lawmakers about how he's going to be responding to COVID, and seems to have a very different approach to the pandemic than the previous Chapalavia and the other administration. So I think that there are key differences. At the end of the day, if you want to talk about politics, this is the politics program. The politics of this are going to be the same. Governor Rauner got criticized up and down the board, particularly from J.B. Pritzker, over Rauner's handling of Quincy. In this case, Pritzker's already getting it from Republicans over his handling of LaSalle, and will continue to throughout the next year. He's not said he's running for re-election, but should he do that, then I think that this is going to be, you know, ripe for the criticisms for Republicans to take advantage of for the next year.
Well, Hannah, are we, other than these hearings that are taking place, I guess what's the next step as far as lawmakers are going to be wrapping up their business in Springfield here at the end of the month? Is that going to be it, or is there other discussion out there what could come next?
There were a couple of comments from folks yesterday, asking Deputy Governor Flores and the new IDVA acting director if there are things that the legislature can and should codify into law to, you know, kind of prevent something like this from happening again. So there are a couple things there. I think there are going to be a few more hearings after we wrap up taping this. The Senate Veterans Affairs Committee this afternoon will have their own hearing on the situation. Other than that, Republicans have called for investigations, or they've called for the Democratic Attorney General Kwame Raoul to open up an investigation into possible criminal negligence. And they've been calling for that since basically the moment the report came out. And they sent the Attorney General a letter this week asking for the same, but they're still maintaining that, you know, they're it's under review. Tony and his colleague Dave McKinney reported earlier this spring, or actually in February, Raul closed an investigation into the Quincy handling of the Quincy situation, because ultimately he was not able to find evidence of criminal negligence in that situation. But still, it's, even though, you know, he's trying to make a nuanced legal case there, and, you know, saying that, like, if the law doesn't merit it, then it doesn't merit it. Surely Republicans are going to use that against him, the governor, too, claiming that somehow Raul is protecting him and by not opening an investigation. So that'll be very interesting to see play out as campaign season gets closer.
You're listening to State Week. I'm Sean Crawford, and our panel includes Charlie Wheeler. Also, we have with us Hannah Meisel and Tony Arnold from WBEZ. Well, we're now in the bridge phase of the state's reopening, and that means that there are some expanded capacity limits, not quite where we want to be, but we're getting closer to that. In fact, the governor says phase 5, a full reopening of the economy, is on track for June 11th, barring some big setback with COVID metrics. And Charlie, I think there are a lot of people that are ready to get out and do things. Others may be a bit hesitant. Now, you're somebody who has hunkered down, mostly stayed at home since this all began. You're vaccinated now. You're as good as anybody to tell me, do you feel comfortable getting out and kind of resuming life once again?
I think I will probably not go back to my old ways quite yet. I actually was on campus yesterday for the first time in 14 months to see my daughter graduate. She was one of the participants in the kind of scaled down ceremony where 8 students at a time would walk across the stage with their families spread out around the Sangamon Auditorium. So that was a very emotional time for me. But other than that, I'm not sure I'm going to get out. And the reason is that we look at what's happening here in our country. We look at how the deaths are down in Illinois and nationally. We look at vaccinations spreading. But look at what happens in other countries. Look what's happening in India or Brazil, for example. And my concern is that in those countries where the virus is running relatively unchecked, there's more of a possibility for mutations. And there's more of a possibility that these new variants that spring up are going to be not affected by the vaccine as effectively as it currently is with the variants we have now. And that's my worry. And I won't feel comfortable going back to full, what would you say, normalcy until the international news looks better, until there's vaccinations more available in places like India and Brazil, and until they get their counts down, because India is just a plane ride away, and there's people going back and forth all the time. Same thing for Brazil. It's not like 100 years ago where India was on the other side of the world, and if you wanted to go there, it would take you forever and a day. Now, people and the virus spread internationally, and so that would be my worry. Now, maybe I'm just more timid than other people. I'm not somebody who's going to be big and brave and go out there, and I'm not as scared of some virus, that kind of attitude.
Yeah, Hannah, has the governor or Dr. Ezeke, have they addressed that possibility? It seems to me that reopening everything, that putting the genie back in the bottle could be a little bit difficult here if things start to go south on us, you know, maybe later in the summer, even early fall. There are going to be a lot of people going, I'm not going back to that again. So are they concerned were they at least asked about that, whether or not there might be some concerns we're moving a little too fast?
They have not indicated that they're concerned about that. You know, they always, when they're asked, they always provide the caveat that we don't have a crystal ball. We can't predict the future. I honestly can't remember if they've been asked about that possibility lately, but you're correct. I mean, it's going to be very hard if, God forbid, COVID, there's another spike, the variants get worse and they're vaccine resistant. Again, knock on wood, it would be very, very hard to tell people to go back inside. And especially with this news this week that the CDC says that folks who are vaccinated don't have to wear masks anymore inside. And the governor saying that he will revise his executive orders to reflect that. That's going to be very difficult to, to say, actually, sorry, you have to put your masks back on, and it's going to be a personal choice. I'm sure plenty of people will continue masking, but as a matter of policy, that's something that you really can't go back on.
Now, we're talking the state on this this movement. Tony, you're in the Chicago area. Chicago's moving in the same direction to reopening?
It is, and if anything, I think the city's, the mayor's shown a willingness at least, or a desire to open more aggressively than the governor has for the state. I think your question here is interesting. I get the impression Illinois is one of the slowest moving states in opening up or expanding capacity at any of these places, especially when you hear about some of the other large states, Texas and Florida come to mind. But as far as the city goes, more people are coming to the ballparks now, or allowed to be in the ballparks, I should say. I just get the impression that the city's going to be full force ahead. There's rumors abound about music festivals and what's coming back and what's not. I won't get into that too much, but it just seems like the city wants to move forward and say, take advantage of the warm weather, go outside, take advantage of the new CDC regulations, and go spend your money.
Let me save just a couple of minutes here at the end. I want to touch base on something we always pay attention to this time of the year, and that is the state's budget. Lawmakers are putting that together. They only have a couple of weeks to adopt a budget and get out on time, as the legislature likes to adjourn at the end of the month. Hannah, the Pritzker administration got some news about spending that federal stimulus aid. What did we learn this week on that?
That's right. So the so-called American Rescue Plan is going to provide Illinois a total of, gosh, I forget the total amount when you count up money to schools and local governments and a bunch of other stuff, but it's a lot. But direct state aid is going to be not the $7.5 million that was reported before, but actually $8.1 billion, which is welcome news, of course, to a state who does not have the best track record with finances, to put it mildly. But that, you know, in an op-ed that the governor wrote with Senate President Don Harmon and House Speaker Chris Welch earlier, I think last month, they said that they were going to use, they were committing to use $2.5 billion of that money to pay off borrowing the state had done from the Federal Reserve last year. But the U.S. Treasury actually now says, well, states can't use that money to pay off debt. The Pritzker, I asked him on, I forget which day it was, but he said, well, you know, that's silly because literally we are trying to pay the federal government back with the money that they're giving us. And so we're going to try to appeal that decision. I'm sure that Illinois is not the only state who's going to try to appeal that. But the question is, when will that happen? Because, you know, the budget has to be wrapped up in the next 2 weeks here, whereas that decision could take as long as 60 days. But the leader Greg Harris, the House Democrats' lead budgeteer, told us reporters yesterday that the plan as of now is to not pay that money back all at once, but actually pay it off in installments over possibly 4 years, starting with $690 million this year in this coming state budget.
Yeah, Charlie, just a couple of minutes here, but there's always that divide over how to spend money. One-time windfall comes in, should you, you know, push it into the budget and suddenly build your expenditures for years to come? Should you pay off the things you owe? What do you think as far as what you're hearing on all of this?
Well, I think this is the time of the year when there's a lot of speculation about what's going to happen with the budget. There's a lot of people wanting to put more money in this line or that line. The one thing we know for sure is that the governor has now committed himself to putting the $350 million into the evidence-based school funding formula, which he had initially said we couldn't afford. How do we handle the debt that we owe to the federal government for what we borrowed? Now, we've appealed, the state has appealed, and as a matter of fact, I think Senator Durbin and a number of other of our congressional people sent a letter to Janet Yellen arguing that the state should be allowed to use this federal money to pay back the money that we borrowed from the state. The argument being the only reason we borrowed this money was to cover some of these expenses related to COVID, and because this Recovery Act is supposed to make people whole for what happened with COVID, it's just not logical that we should not be allowed to use that. And I'm thinking that we'll probably get an okay for that, but it is going to be something that, as was said, as Hannah said, we're not going to get it in time to get the budget in place before the scheduled adjournment at the end of May, and maybe not even in time for when the fiscal year starts on July 1st. So it's going to be a difficulty. But one thing I'm pretty sure we won't do, which was common in the past, a generation ago, was where we would start a program, a $100 million program, and we didn't have enough money to fund it in this year's budget. So instead of starting it at the start of the fiscal year, we'll start it January 1st, halfway through the fiscal year, and we'll only have to spend $50 million. And of course, the following fiscal year, then you got to come up with the other 50. So we're not going to do that. And I'm also, I think it's a good sign that the governor and the legislative leaders had all agreed to use this money to pay off the debt more than anything else. That would be our first priority, what we owe to the federal government, also what we owe to our other state funds from which we borrowed like $1 billion, what we owe to the treasurer's office for money we borrowed there. So I think the commitment is, however we're able to do it, we're going to try and use this federal money to pay off our debt as opposed to starting new programs.
It's time now for our notes from the field, and let's start with Hannah.
Sure. A week ago, every first Friday of every month, the Bureau of Labor Statistics puts out a monthly jobs report. An economist had been predicting that in April, the U.S. economy would have added a million plus jobs, but it was something like a quarter million. So folks started kind of freaking out about that. And all of a sudden, you've seen so many stories about, labor shortage. And, Republican-led states have recently announced that they are going to end early the federal unemployment benefit enhancement, which is this $300 a week that's supposed to last until September 1st. The governor, he was asked about this the other day, and he said, no, we're not going to pull the rug out from under people. That didn't stop one of the state's leading business groups from writing a letter urging the governor to do so anyway. I called up an academic at UIC who kind of studies the labor market and particularly warehouse economy, because that's been such a boom in the last decade or so. She doesn't necessarily find merit with the argument that it's these enhanced unemployment benefits that are keeping people out of work. It's maybe more of a function of the American labor market was kind of broken before the pandemic, and COVID kind of revealed things like, if you're a woman, if you're a mother in the workplace, and all of a sudden a pandemic hits and schools and shut down, daycare shuts down or is otherwise unaffordable, then you're going to be kicked out of the labor market. And data has borne that out.
And Charlie.
Well, the governor announced this week a tourism advertising campaign designed to attract visitors to Illinois. And one might say, well, what's the big deal about that? Well, in a normal year, we would get something like 120 million visitors coming to the state. And they'd spend more than $40 billion, which of course is good for the state's economy, and it's also good for the state's finances. There's something like 20,000 hotel workers who still are out of work because people aren't making hotel reservations. So the point of this campaign, and it's called Time for Me to Drive, not to Chicago and Springfield, but for example, Galena up in the northwest corner, or the Garden of the Gods in southern Illinois. And it's going to be directed mainly at our surrounding states, the notion being that people are going to be more inclined to drive somewhere for a vacation rather than get on a plane and fly.
All right, that's all the time we have for this episode of State Week. Our panel included Charlie Wheeler, Hannah Meisel, and Tony Arnold with WBEZ. You can get a podcast of our show at nprillinois.org and through the NPR One app. And don't forget to join us next time. I'm Sean Crawford.
You've been listening to State Week, a program of commentary and analysis of events in Illinois state politics and government. State Week is produced in the state capital by public radio station NPR Illinois. This is IPR, Illinois Public Radio.